Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about my heartache. I'll tell you about my heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about my hopeless life, the meager food for soul for God. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Well, I was going to go with the roof is leaking, but this one seems like it's more apropos. And the boys getting it started here. Welcome to another exciting edition of Overtime. I'm your host, Dr. Market Culture Vulture. The number to call to interrupt me from my dialogue with myself is, as always, 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. You podcasting mofos. We're on here live every week. You can call, interrupt me once in a while. Bring me an idea or something. I'm out here by myself here, waving my freak flag. But tonight we'll be joined by the one and only Douglas Rushkoff at 9:30. So set your clocks for a little hauntification. Because we have the world is burning to hell going on here as we embrace the new moon coming in this weekend, and get ready for the final cycle of the fall as loss in the future comes our way. And, you know, we didn't stop short of that this week. I tell you, I look at the topic, and we're talking about December as we get into the consumerism of the holidays. And happy Hanukkah out there, everybody, if you're out there celebrating the first night of Hanukkah that started tonight. So we're officially in the throes of it, and you could kind of feel it. I mean, for some reason, they really went out of their way with the Black Friday sales and some of the stores even being open on Thanksgiving now, and some of the sales starting before Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday. And what is going on? We don't have any money! Now, why we're still in the throes of this thing, and they're still offering us more sales and more garbage, is, you know, it kind of all goes full circle. When you combine war, poverty, oppression, insanely unbalanced economics all over the world, you get a lot of leaks, don't you? Okay, I get that. Don't you wish your girlfriend was... Anyway, what I wanted to start with was the news, make a news here on sometime. A couple hours ago, the good folks at an Amazon pulled the old plug on our friends at WikiLeaks. Amazon.com, this is over on the HuffPost if you want to go check it out. It's everywhere. I mean, it's been retweeted and, oh my God, 4,500 comments already. Amazon pulled the plug on hosting WikiLeaks today amidst increasing political pressure. Associated Press reports. I need like a typewriter in the background. Amazon.com forced WikiLeaks to stop using the U.S. company's computers to distribute embarrassing State Department communications and other documents. Stop embarrassing us! Gotta keep our composure! The ouster came after congressional staff had questioned Amazon about its relationship with WikiLeaks. Said Senator Joe Lieberman, the most boring man in America, an independent from Connecticut. Ugh, God. WikiLeaks confirmed it hours after the Associated Press reported that Amazon service had stopped hosting the WikiLeaks website. I just went over there. They must have found another friend. The site was unavailable for several hours before it moved to its previous Swedish host in Banhof. WikiLeaks tweeted in response, WikiLeaks servers at Amazon ousted. Free speech, the land of the free. Fine, our money is now spent to employ people in Europe. So back to the Swedish people. Hold on, coughing time. Yeah. And later, if Amazon are so comfortable with the First Amendment, they should get out of the business of selling books. A little snag on the back door. Keep up with the latest WikiLeaks in our continuous updated live blog below. Now, the guy that runs the WikiLeaks, Mr. Assange, Julian Assange, is now wanted by Interpol for rape. Do you think this case has a little bit of "we'll show you" on it? I mean, Lord, he took him to the freaking woodshed over the weekend, exposing a lot of global dirty tricks going on. Gee, I don't know. People don't fight fair in a war. Oh, I don't know. Maybe there's a little bit of a collusion going on amongst some of the countries there. Ooh, maybe there's some money being funneled over here and there. What is so new about this? It's like they said, they reported that they discovered the government knew about aliens. They'd be like, come on. The government lies to you just like your parents do for your own good. So now we got this Julian Assange guy who can't find him. So, of course, I turned to my good friends at Fox News, who are on top of this, to cover the ins and outs. So here's a little report that was posted earlier today on Fox News discussing the whereabouts and the relevance of this rape case that suddenly appeared this afternoon on Fox News. Here you go.
Meantime, Julian Assange's lawyer now claims his client is being persecuted by Swedish authorities after the international police organization Interpol put him on its most wanted list. Prosecutors there in Sweden looking to meet with Assange after two women there accused him of sexual molestation and rape. In past interviews, he's called these accusations baseless. And his lawyer now questions the timing of all of this. Of course, in order to talk to Assange, police first have to find the guy. He doesn't have a permanent address that we know of. He often travels from country to country. He's a slippery guy. Joining us now, former prosecutor, Fox News legal analyst, Arthur Idala. We'll call him birthday boy for today's purposes. And the criminal defense attorney, Larry, Randy Zellin, who someday will have a birthday, but it's not today.
You know, today.
We focus on Julian Assange. When we learn so many things about this war and the way that it's being prosecuted, we learn so much about our friends over there, but all we want to talk about is a leak. Okay, now they want to pick him up for rape or something. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, how could you argue against that if it's true? America's most wanted, what do? They highlight, they figure out the 10 most people they want to grab, and they do these
people they want to grab.
You know, the 10 most wanted people, and the 10 people who are the most heinous people. Mm. So what do they do here? I would like to use the term, Shep, you live by technology, you live by notoriety, then you're going to die by it. Yep. So this is a case that maybe would have slipped through the cracks, but he's going to be out there and say, hey, here I am, I'm the guy. Well, is anybody going to argue that if he really did commit a rape, he shouldn't be prosecuted for it?
No, certainly not. Randy?
Why are we talking about a rape?
I don't know.
Because
does anybody care?
But, yeah, I would think the woman who got raped.
Happy birthday. Take it down a notch. It's not about a rape case.
The point is well taken. None of this is about rape.
None of this is about a rape case.
We wouldn't be talking about this if it weren't for the fact that he WikiLeaked us.
We wouldn't be talking about any celebrity case if it wasn't for that person was a celebrity.
But this is not a celebrity rape case. This is not a celebrity. Once again, we are showing our ineptitude and how embarrassing our system is. Why don't we be honest and say, you know what? We really want this guy because he's embarrassed us, made us look really bad. Somebody a lot smarter than me about 20 seconds ago said, What have we learned from this guy? We're screwing up in Afghanistan. We ain't winning this war. There's a lot wrong that this country doesn't know about that just found out about.
You're throwing America under the bus.
Well,
it's Sweden that's doing
it. No, we are doing it. You don't think we're pulling the strings here?
I read exactly what the prosecutor in Sweden said. She said they've been looking for him for over a month.
What was the last time you heard about Sweden doing anything?
Look, the bottom line is, if you want to escalate things, if you want to be the guy, every celebrity case that you and I step in here and cover, if the person's name wasn't that popular name, we wouldn't be standing here covering.
But this is not a
celebrity. This guy became a celebrity, so now if someone's saying he raped them, now he's got to pay the price.
It's not a rape case. What this case is about to its core, it's simply this. Investigative journalism was born with the Declaration of Independence, when Thomas Jefferson said, let the world know what Britain is doing. The press is the watchdog for us, so we know what's going on. What this guy has done is gone to the internet and exposed the insanity of what we don't know about. Why don't we start with the people who are saying these moronic things, never thinking that they're going to see the light of day?
They weren't supposed to see the light of day. The problem is somebody allowed them to be stolen. They weren't just stolen. They were put in a position to be stolen.
But Assange didn't steal them. All he did was take them off of the internet. We are talking about enforcing a law that goes back to 1917, where we were worried about code decks and sketchbooks. What did this guy do? He didn't give away.
Randy, you have to go to a 1918 law to get this.
And Randy, are you telling me?
Are you telling me
you've never represented a client in a criminal case where the prosecutors have astutely used a different law to get him? How about a guy named Al Capone? Now, I know you didn't represent him, but what about Al Capone?
Tell me about your representation of Al Capone. It is your birthday.
I'm not watching.
It just ended the last.
Time we tried this in 2009, it didn't work out so well. Well, we had to walk away from the case because the espionage.
We're not doing it, bro.
Isn't the bottom line they want this guy?
Correct.
And they're pushing Sweden to follow through on a case that they already had. They want him.
Yeah.
Know what they're worried about now? They're worried now that he's got this hard drive from the Bank of America. I don't know that he has it, but I know in 2009 he said he had, 5 gigabytes?
Yeah, the bank net.
It's like 600, I don't know, some hundreds of thousands of pagers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to bring down the United States military and our State Department. It's another thing to mess with the big bank. Well, I don't know all the facts about it, but he says he's going to put them out. And they don't want that to happen anymore.
And in my opinion, as an American who loves my lifestyle here, they should do everything they can to come down on this guy. And
so you're not glad on some level that people realize that President Karzai is seen by many as just, you know, motivated by paranoia, that there was $52 million in a suitcase that his brother had, as you're just walking through, where'd that come from, that he let his brother, the heroin dealer, off, that he pardoned a bunch of criminals, that he's not a very good partner in this thing, and that we're expected to turn over security of this nation to that guy and his people, and that was worth $2.5 billion a week, and our young men and women's lives. I think it's probably good that people know that, and I think you agree.
Your response? I think it's very good that people who make these decisions should know all this. But, Shepard, I have no involvement in what we turn over, what we don't turn over. Yes, I think it's awesome that Secretary Clinton and the President of the United States and all the former
chief of staff of the Army said yesterday in this position that if people had realized what was going on with the Gulf War when it began, with the Iraq War when it began in 2003, that we were diverting resources from this war, that the nation could not sustain it. And he said yesterday, if the people had known about it back then, that this war might not have gotten to this place. And maybe now, on some level, it's good that we know our partner in this war, Hamid Karzai, is not an actor with whom we ought to be dealing. He's just all we got.
But I would like to think that President Bush and all these people around him knew that, and they made the calculated risk, and these are the people we elected, and they're the ones. Yes, I like to know it from a personal
stand. You don't think people ought to know anything.
If it compromises our security,
and they're very,
you know, just
they're varying takes on whether.
But what has been compromised?
You
the
go.
Fact that Gaddafi
you know, all this stuff
Flamenco?
Was already out there. All this stuff was really already out there. None of this stuff was top secret. More than 2 million Americans have access to this database. You know, if that's top secret, then all right, it's top secret.
You're good.
I happen to read a little bit.
I have to say a thing. You're good.
It's worth the wait. Happy birthday, Arthur.
Happy birthday. Later.
Happy
birthday.
Arthur's birthday.
He's paying tonight.
He's paying.
Yeah, all right. Chuckles McGee over here. The world's burning, and these guys are laughing and talking about their lifestyle. It's time for a commercial. No, could you shut up? Look at this. So that's the WikiLeaks story, but it gets so much more involved. The more you dig on it, it's really a lot of the veil and the ability we've had to kind of like not think about this stuff and put it out of our consciousness, because we're always focused on what's happening locally. I mean, we're not really set up to process, you know, global events in our tiny little brains and be able to deal with that. It's called allostasis, you know, that allostatic load, that cognitive pressure that we're on. These are riddles that we can't solve. It's like, it's bad enough we know if somebody's been murdered, raped, or you know, otherwise abused within 35 miles of our home, the incident happens. But this kind of stuff, where you just have high-level crooks, and then you have snoops on snoops. We live in that TMZ gotcha culture now, and this is just the next wave of it. WikiLeaks, to me, is an inevitability, and there's no secrets anymore. I feel like playing the Beretta song. Let's see if I can find that quick. That's kind of what I'm into right now. I want to hear the Beretta song. Beretta theme song. Oh, you got to love the YouTube. Let's see if we got it here. And that's kind of the whole theme of the show, really. Here it is. Ta-da-dee. Little Beretta. Hit me. Sammy Davis. I love this. Classic. All right. Love the bird, though.
Don't go to bed with no price on your head. No. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Don't do it. Don't do it. I can't take it. I got Sammy Davis Jr. The theme for our economy is don't do it. That's why I can't take any of this. It's like, it's goofy. It is goofy what's going on out there. And we're all in it. We're all in it now. We're in it into over our heads. Oh, my God. I don't even know what this is about. What is this about? Just go away. Oh, my God. So that's that thing, right? So we put that to bed. Now, the next thing that comes up is poor old Ireland is falling apart. So, you know, they've got problems with the IMP in Europe, and they're basically a couple of steps ahead of us on the path to solvency. As the country melts. So I turn to our good friends, Larry King and Sarah Palin, to discuss the situation in Ireland and their bailout.
Hey, Sarah. What's up, girl?
Yo, Annie, baby. I'm trying to figure out what's going down in Ireland.
It's really not complicated. There's a chance even you might be able to understand it. Okay. Ireland's large banks made billions of euro of reckless loans to property developers. Most of this money came from German, French, and British banks.
I think I understand so far.
Well, we haven't gotten far, so even my four-year-old granddaughter would have understood that. Anyway, when the property market crashed, these private banks effectively became insolvent. The Irish government stepped in to guarantee these banks so that they could remain open.
Open. I like open. It's so much better than closed.
Rather than letting these private banks fail and the German, French, and English banks who loan the money take a very tight haircut, the government then agreed to pay these banks back every cent.
Pay them back with what?
The funds of the Irish taxpayers.
Why should Irish taxpayers pay back debts they don't owe to foreign banks who deserve to lose the money they recklessly loaned?
They shouldn't. It's pretty obvious that the politicians were looking after their banking friends rather than the people who elected them. The government tried to justify it by claiming that honoring the debts of the banks would ensure Ireland would receive favorable rates from the international bond markets where they go for loans.
But that doesn't make sense. Little I know that Ireland now has to pay more than Iceland for debt, and that country defaulted on its bankers' debt. But even if the Irish people had to pay back the foreign banks for money they don't owe, it wouldn't matter as the Irish don't have the money.
That's where the IMF come in, to protect their buddies and the European banks from taking the loss they deserve. They gave the Irish government a loan so that they could afford to pay back the European banks. They then called it a bailout. It was really a bailout for European banks that the Irish taxpayer has to pay for.
Larry, that makes me sad. Like when somebody says that I am few sandwiches short of a picnic and I don't know what it means. So what should the Irish people do now?
Firstly, they should dump their existing government and only elect a leader committed to defaulting on this private sector debt, which they don't owe.
You mean they should do what Iceland did?
Yes. The Icelandic people had a vote on the matter, and they voted to not pay back the debt that the people didn't run up. That country is now not saddled with debt for generations like the way Ireland is.
But it would be more wrong not to pay back a debt.
No. It would be more wrong for the Irish people to pay money they don't owe to banks that deserve to lose it for making bad loans. The Irish people should launch a big campaign in their country to ensure they stop paying this money. One of the biggest problems is that many people in Ireland don't fully understand what is happening.
So what can they do?
Eventually. When everybody fully understands what has happened, they won't let the government get away with robbing the people.
Maybe I should go over there to help them.
No, I think you'd only make things worse. You know what? On second thoughts, you should go and spend a very long time there. Like 40 or 50 years.
There you go, from extra normal, you gotta love them. Ugh, oh, boy. I don't know. Do I need more of this? I think I do. There you go, Ireland. So again, we're talking about debt, and there's all levels of debt here. There's a lot of ways you can play this thing through in your mind so you understand how effed up it is. It is foobar. You can't, when you've got something like WikiLeaks that is running circles around the Interpol and the Justice Department, and it's holding these banks out, you know, that they're going to expose the Bank of America. When you've got that much information that is free-floating all over the web, and you've got these scamming, thieving, lying, well, where are they? I can't, every week, you know, I got to get the Batman in, otherwise he takes it up the server.
You filthy criminals.
Right. You got these guys out there that are doing nothing more or less than stealing. This is no different than watching the stagecoach in the Wild West. There's no one regulating the stuff on the web. It is the Wild West. It's a digital Wild West. But it's still unregulated. There's no boundaries. There's nobody minding the store. And everybody's got their hand in the cookie jar. Drug dealers, warlords, you know, dictators, bankers, they're all in there. It's a big mosh pit of greedy slobs. Hope you're listening tonight. Again, you can call in 646 if you are one of the banksters and have some information to share. Maybe WikiLeaks is listening. Who knows? 646-478-4847. The chat room is open. If you have a question you want to pass along, I will pop it open because our guests will be here in a minute. And I'd love to share some of the audience's ideas with him and get you guys involved in this little discussion because it does sort of impact us and the little people here in the little tiny little village of beautiful downtown Larchmont as we get into our little holiday mode. Spending the money that we don't have.
that's the way it is.
So let's see. We covered WikiLeaks in Ireland.
How about the Bush tax cuts for 200, Jack? Well, why not? There we go. Here's a little little take on what's going on with that from Brave New Foundation. Enjoy.
I saw a clean midnight on December 31st, 2010. Bush tax cuts will expire. Since 2001, CEOs and the super rich have enjoyed obscene tax cuts from Bush. Meanwhile, the recession has taken over the entire population. But the super rich don't care. They use their evil tax cuts to buy things like big boats, rocket ships, private islands, castles, huge rocks, Greek gods, dogs and sweaters, and cheap labor. How does this happen? The super rich control an army of congressional zombies. Feed off of green fuel to gain strength. As they grow stronger, the congressional zombies only serve and protect their super rich masters. And this is how a handful of the super rich control most of the wealth, while the rest of us are left to fend for ourselves. Now, who will save us? Only you have the power to stop the greed. Break the zombie spell. Say no to the super rich tax cuts. Call Congress today.
All right, there's your little mock up on that. You got your tax cuts. You got your Ireland fishing around. You got your WikiLeaks. Who's going to pay Jeter? That's all I want to know. You know? And all this is all I care about.
What the fuck was he talking about?
That's right. That's right. Because at the end of the day, I want my baseball. You know, because it's like, I'm kind of like the way that guy was in that clip before. So much of this is operating, it's in the mesosphere. I mean, we can't touch it. The system is so fragmented, it's a smithereen the second after the detonation. You know, it's like it's already fragmenting, it's already unraveling. And now we're starting to get some of the debris is falling from the sky. And we're starting to see this thing play out. And ultimately, like I said, who can we turn to if we know the government is not trustworthy? They're dysfunctional parents. We know the military is basically at this point sort of a tentacle, I'll call it, of a lot of corporate stuff and a lot of ways to justify things. And that's why these leaks make all these politicos look so, you know, phony as they are. And then you look at the other things that are happening internationally and globally with the economy. We didn't mention China and a whole bunch of other things. We'll get to that with Rushkoff when he calls in. And all of this affects the way you live because it's a social stress everyone has to deal with. Now, whether you're dealing with your own local situation, your 401k, and your retirement, and my Social Security benefits, and that'd be yabba-dabba-dabba-dabba, makes me nuts. Because what was the purpose of money anyway? In the beginning, gold, right, things like that were real, were exchange units. They were ways to basically create a value system that was somewhat fair. Once we've gotten into these systems that we're in now, we'll get into that a little bit with Douglas when he calls in. We've taken the value out of the exchange, and now we're just dealing with control. We're dealing with a political tool. So with no further ado, I will summon the Rushkoff with this.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
All right. Joining us from the other side of the richest county in New York, we have author and expert in all things media and otherwise, Douglas Rushkoff. Welcome back to Summertime.
I couldn't let you go on any longer. I had to call and stop you.
Yeah, I was getting a little diabolical there with all the clips. I can't stand myself sometimes. I've just had it today. I've had it. I came out of the driveway here, and my tire decided to retire, and I ended up rolling into the mechanic at 5:15 with a tire that just decided to kill itself, and the mechanics had a good chuckle at my expense. And I was sort of thinking about that in terms of, like, you know, industry in general. There's no service anymore. There's just...
You should
repair.
Have put your car
Everything
on suicide watch, though, weeks ago.
What's that?
You should have put that poor car on suicide watch weeks ago.
Oh, that car is trying to kill itself or me in the same day. I've poured almost $4,000 into that car since Labor Day, and it's still chugging along, one tire at a time. It's pathetic. With this tire, just the steel radio just came right through and just like ripped right through the tire.
Don't touch it. It's very sharp.
I'm telling you. Yeah, oh, yeah, I found that the hard way when they were taking the tire.
Yeah, I know. I've ripped my hand open on that before.
Yeah, well, tires are funny. They're built very. They have a very interesting anatomy, as I found out winningly this afternoon. But all that, you know, kind of rolls the other direction here when we look at WikiLeaks, which is fascinating to me because you, of all people, straddling all these different disciplines as they roam around the data sphere. When you go back, even just kind of roll the tape back to when Twitter was involved in the Iranian elections a while ago. And there was all this consciousness where, hey, well, we could use social media for good. We can raise consciousness. We can actually shift things. Then you get something like WikiLeaks, which is sort of like that principle on steroids. And now you have whole governments, you know, diving under the sofa cushions to find out, how do these people find out about these things? And it's to me, it's a very interesting, a week removed from the whole TSA thing and the airport thing. And, you know, is this a new kind of much more systemic, stealthy kind of terror that actually has the protectors a little nervous?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, my standard reply for the last 20 years on this kind of thing would be that the internet is like truth serum. You know, that when you have bottom-up, interactive, side-to-side, horizontal media, it's very hard to maintain a myth. You know, it's very hard for governments and corporations alike to maintain their sort of mythic narratives in a deconstructing media space. You know, this is the mashup. This is when anything can be taken apart, when any little fact will rise to the top, will find its way there. It's not just some, you know, loser in Austin who's telling his friends about his conspiracy. It's everywhere. And, you know, facts do have a way of trickling to the top. The problem is, I feel like our population is utterly unprepared to deal with factual information, you know, to the point where there's so much fact and false fact and everything else out there that it almost doesn't matter. And then, you know, I get to the point where I look at this thing, this leak, and I think, well, yeah, it's this leak and it's this whole bad thing for all these governments. But on the other hand, I have to wonder, is it really a leak? You know, is it really who gets served by it in the end? And I see Obama as tremendously served by this leak. You know, in a time when he can't get his missile treaty passed and everybody's saying he's a wimp, all of a sudden this information comes out, which actually makes him look a bit more like he's been working, like he's been doing stuff, like America behind the scenes is actually more powerful than they've seemed in front of the scenes. If nothing else, we see that a whole lot of governments have actually just been basically afraid to come out of the closet and admit that they're our allies. You know, so
well, we've been dealing with dictators and all kinds of unsavory characters for years. I mean, going back, I mean, into you know,
the oh, everything, really. Yeah, with Iran and Noriega, and I mean,
it's almost as if we're watching a Jerry Bruckheimer film. You know, we're so desensitized to this stuff. You know, where's Nicolas Cage when we need him? You know, it's like I'm watching a movie. That always ends with us getting more jaded, more wistful, more distrustful. And these are the instruments, these are the crude tools we have to sort of kind of guide the whatever, I guess, kind of little buffer we have against us and the world. Because the economy, I mean, the more I watch countries pop like light bulbs and become part of this, like, you know, the whatever's going on in Europe, whatever country is in the meat grinder today, you know, Ireland this week, it's been several countries that have been kind of on the brink. And we kind of watch here almost as if the way we watched World War One, like, hey, what's going on over there? We're way over here. We're an ocean away. But we're a mouse click away at this point. And so we're not that far removed from Obama's trip, you know,
when he went to China, kind of like hat in hand, and it just seems like we're almost not desensitized, but we're almost sort of like waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's almost kind of like you talk about in a book that everyone should probably be reading on street corners now, Coercion, from probably about 12 years ago now, where we're so used to the narrative, like you talked about before, having a beginning and a middle and an end, that we're living in a postmodern world now that doesn't do that. It just keeps cycling and spurring and going around and around. And so it circles the drain and never really kind of like comes to a fruition. More stuff gets put into that mix, so more stuff destabilizes. So it affects more things. So it's like we can't, like I said before, our little tiny brains can't process how bad it really is. So from a media standpoint, when you're looking out at the way the world is, and I don't want to say marketing this stuff, but they can't cause the hysteria that they really should be causing, and yet they can't hide from it anymore because it's coming out from every corner of the social media. So how do you send it in the eye of the storm? How do you convey this message to someone who's dealing with the local effects of all this stuff while the global effects are swirling all around them? Do they just kind of like assume the crash position and wait for the little munchkins to come out, or how do we deal with that?
Well, in a way, it seems like we were happier when we could keep pushing stuff into the future and when we could feel like we were part of this kind of a longer story. I mean, the only way a business ever makes money is by convincing people they're going to make more money in the future. You know, the only way we made money with books was kind of, I mean, it's not like it was false accounting, but if you ever really looked at what you've got, you're going to panic, right? Because you don't really have anything. You don't have enough savings. You don't have enough this. No company does. It's always the construction of these fantasies about the future that kind of keep the whole thing going. And what we're looking at now is partly because we passed the millennium and we've changed from being so future-focused to being more present-focused, we're also in a medium that, unlike television and newspapers and all these story things that really kind of put you in a timeline, we're in a medium that feels very, very present tense. And when it's present tense, people look at, well, what's actually happening now? What is the situation in Iraq, you know, in a sort of endless war like Afghanistan? We don't have the same kind of goals that you do. Oh, we're going to bring down this dictator like Hitler. And, you know, you don't have these overarching narratives. So people really look at, well, what's it all for? You know, people are much less concerned, I think, with where are we going as a country than what have we got left as a country. And you can't ask that question. It's like, you know, if you're ever in a moment that's whether you're on an acid trip or having sex or this or that, if you stop to think what's actually going on now, you're going to screw the whole thing up. You know, why am I enjoying this feeling of friction against my sexual parts? It's like, you can't think like that. It's got to be, oh, baby, this is going to pierce the universal veil. You know, it's always got to be this kind of other thing. And when you don't have the other thing there, that's really frightening. I mean, in some sense, it's a very positive thing. It's a return to in the body. Your feet are on the ground. What's going on right now? But what's going on right now is a really scary place for people to go. You know, and that's sort of, when I look at WikiLeaks, it's like, that's about, well, how is this actually happening? When these scandals and things are from a long time ago, you don't really worry about it. And you say, well, that was, you know, that was Noriega. That was, you know, that was the Iran-Contra affair, you know, whatever. That was something else. That was, you know, Ali North. It looks like it's ancient history. When it's now, it feels really different.
Well, I mean, and we had Paul Garcia on from the Merlin Project a couple weeks ago talking about how things cycle through 7 years, 21 years, you know, these repetitive events, history repeating itself, so to speak, in a rhythm. And then you look at this stuff, and it is sort of like you feel like I said, we're so desensitized, I think we've reached that saturation point where we can't put the genie back in the bottle, but we sort of lost the bottle. And the relevance of this stuff, because the boundaries are gone, and the structure's gone, and that narrative of having things like a crisis rise and fall and go away, everything sort of smolders now. So stuff that you thought was done just starts rising up again. It's much more of an emergent kind of frothy thing going on. So when you try to follow something like this, we're a month or so removed from the election. We were all set to, we're just going to focus on these tax cuts now. And then all of a sudden something comes out of left field. And it's like you start thinking about, well, you talked about before, if we can't hide in the future and just speculate and keep just kind of fly casting and hope it gets better, and because we always had that as an out as a country and as a sort of as an ethos, really.
Right.
We always preach the future is better than the present. You could never say the future is worse than the present. Why would you go to the future then? So what I see happening is the opposite, is that, and I've seen even some remnants of it early in the holiday season, is people are getting sort of like a nostalgic high being consumers again. I mean, I was talking about before how the Black Friday thing, where a year ago, 2 years ago, was like, heck with that, I don't have any money. And now they're back charging stuff, and they're looking for sales, and it's that sort of like, the rush, almost like a
they
drug.
Are. The cycles are so short. It's like, it used to be I'm going to save up for a house or a thing, or something big. Now it's
right.
Like you get a Garmin GPS in your car, and it's like, oh, I can't wait to put that in my car. And that's just going to happen tomorrow or this afternoon when you get back from Walmart. So the notion of the whole context for everything we do has become very, very immediate. It's why people, in terms of their investing, when they're going to gold, it's not because they're thinking they're going to make a lot of money. What they're looking at is they're no longer looking at growth or what they used to call capital appreciation. Everybody's thinking more in terms of capital preservation. It's almost as if our best whatever that was behind us, and we're just going to try to hang on as best we can. I find myself looking at my life now in terms of, well, how long do I really have to hang on here? How much money do I have to make it to the finish line? And that's not the sort of open-ended American optimistic, Pollyannish, Frank Baum, Wizard of Oz, Emerald City kind of ethos that fuels, the great American dream. It's much more almost like Europe in the 1970s kind of, okay, our empire's over. Now what can we do? In the best of worlds, what that does is leads to a kind of a sustainability mentality, which would be a great thing, both for our bodies and the environment and the economy and everything else. In other words, we no longer have the obligation to grow at the tremendous rates required by capitalism, but instead all we have to do is manage, is feed ourselves and our children, and then use our surplus to, to look for meaning, and look for meaning in the moment, rather than create these kind of false structures, to postpone our experience of meaning and satisfaction to death or beyond.
And I think that plays out in all the paranoia about Social Security, which is going to be the next, big pinata to burst.
Right. No one I know. I mean, I get that little, green fringed form from Social Security every year, saying, oh, if you retire at this age, you're going to get, $1,700 a month or whatever. No one believes that that's really going to happen anyway. I don't know anybody.
Yeah, I think, like I said, that's like the year after you found out there's no Santa Claus, there's no Easter Bunny, there's no Tooth Fairy. You still want the dollar under your pillow for the tooth. You still want presents to come on December 25th. You still want, the Easter Bunny to bring you candy. They don't buy into the story anymore. So how does the government, especially this government, which is so interested in control rather than coordinating anything, it's like a bar of soap, how do they contain a bunch of, I'll say, a pre-adolescent mindset that's like, we're not toddlers anymore thinking the government's going to protect us or support us. The government is becoming like a really abusive, dysfunctional parent that's going on a bender. And the kids are going, oh, okay, we got to fend for ourselves now. How do they especially Obama, who came across from such a different angle, not as a typical, you know, kind of like we know the profile coming in. How do they get the country back into a mentality where things can happen right now? Because we've been on delay for just about everything that they proposed in the last 2 years. How do you get off the service road and back on you know, regular speed highway here when there's so many, you know, kind of like, you know, obstacles on the path, both for the individual and for the collective? How do you get them to say, okay, play ball again? We can, you know, it's like,
well,
a NASCAR race with the yellow flag.
The opportunity of the Obama administration was you know, he explained it in the rhetoric of his campaign, but didn't enact it in the civics of his government. You know, the idea was, when you say we are the thing we've been waiting for, that is a testament to presentism. You know, we are the thing we've been waiting for means that, you know, we are going to now participate in our government. We are going to enact democracy by the people. And the problem is, as he enacted his government, it really became much more about, you know, government for the people, you know, which was actually Ed Bernays, the original public relations guru, talked about this. You know, he didn't believe that Americans were or would ever be capable of enacting their own democracy. He believed in a more sort of consumerist model of democracy, where mm-hmm. smart people run the government for the benefit of the people and then use public relations to convince them that this is whatever they're doing is in their best interest, which, if they're benevolent, it is. You know, and what Obama presented was, no, you know, we are going to have to actually do this ourselves. So the answer for people, I think, is very scaled and small actions that make their lives and their communities better. You know, the more communities can create and retain the value that they've created, the better off they're going to be, the less help they're going to need, and the less government they're going to need to bail them out with funds that don't actually exist. You know, and that's a matter of in some sense, it's the technological equivalent of, you know, doing things by wiki. You know, it's actually getting down to business and taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, and again, this is we're talking with Douglas Rushkoff here. Now, bridging the gap between where you were in your mindset when you were sitting in front of the typewriter putting together Life, Inc., and where you were a year or so ago putting together the new book, Program or Reprogram, because they're basically the big end and the small end of a funnel of a whole set of ideas that have been kind of streaming through your mind for the last, I don't know, half a dozen years or so. As you've watched these things unfold, as you've watched the Internet myth, the myths around the Internet deconstruct themselves, where it was going to be this big, you know, idealistic savior, and then, God, it touched the Midas, and it all turned into dust again. So as the bubbles collapsed, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, boom, 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 and you're watching all this happen, knowing it's not capitalism that killed it, it was corporatism and consumerism on top of that, and now we came, because it was unregulated, and now you see it folding back on itself, because now we're forced to go into local currencies and decentralized currencies and barter systems in some places, you know, that because of the fact that we can't get credit, we can't get loans, we can't extend our future financially, so to speak. Now, relate that to the evolution of the web, which has gone the other way, which has allowed more interconnectivity in the present moment to the point where there is no news cycle. There's like news drops, literally WikiLeaks, that sort of rain down on us and pull out and ripple out. So as you watch this evolve, both, you know, longitudinally or chronologically, and also, you know, on a cardinal level, like on an ordinal level, like that moment of whoa, that heaviness of the moment come over people, whether it's a terrorist thing or whether it's another economic hit or whatever the amber alert is du jour, how do you see those two things playing out with the evolution of the media going up and the deconstruction of all these things that we used to be able to hide in, kind of analog and trailing off? How do you see your two books and that thing connecting the dots there.
Well, I mean, simply stated, I mean, the opportunity of the net was to see the way the world was programmed. You know, for those of us who were TV babies, you know, once we got onto a computer or onto the net, we saw, oh my gosh, look at what we can do with the TV set, which was basically the monitor. We saw that the world we'd been living in had been, you know, programmed by people, that we had spent our lives content to receive the programming of whoever was making television, and now we were in a position to put what we wanted on the screen, to connect to other people through these screens, so that we were the programmers. And then when you have experiences like that online, you start to see the world differently. You start to see everything from the way the streets in your town are organized to the way money works to the way education works as programs that were designed by people to lead to certain kinds of results. Not all nefarious. It's not all conspiracy. It's just none of this stuff was made by God. This stuff was made by people, and it all tilts in favor of certain people and certain groups and certain agendas. And that insight, I thought, was something that everybody would have when they experienced the net, when they experienced interactive media. But by the time interactive media got into everybody's hands on everybody's screens, it had been these potentials had been muted in favor of, you know, Amazon.com and Facebook and other kinds of activities that were much less kind of revolutionary and mind opening and mind altering in their construction. So I wrote Life Inc., you know, which is really looking at money as a medium to really apply the lesson for people. And to take, I didn't really talk about the net in it, but to take what I had learned from being on the net, that what I had learned about how everything that's out there is there for reasons, you know, I used that insight and applied it to money. And I just said, okay, this stuff called money and these things called corporations, when did they come about? Who made them and what did they make them for? And I found out, oh, I get it. You know, it turns out historically there was all these other kinds of money, and they were made illegal by kings who wanted people to use coin of the realm. You know, why was that? Because they wanted anyone who used money to borrow it from the central treasury and pay it back at interest, and it was a way to really preserve the feudalism that was being broken down at the end of the late Middle Ages by merchants and a rising middle class and a peer-to-peer economy that had led to great, great prosperity. You know, it was great prosperity, but it was only for the people. It wasn't for the aristocracy. So they undid it, you know, by creating corporations which were really just chartered monopolies so that people couldn't be in business for themselves. They had to work for one of the companies that had been exclusively chartered to work in their industry, or they had to use centralized currency, which was money that had to be borrowed. So you couldn't just transact with people anymore using whatever currency you wanted. You had to transact using this very expensive coin of the realm. And I wrote that book to show how, you know, those tendencies, that the embedded biases of corporations and the embedded biases of centralized currency were going to lead us into a really difficult economy as the cycle, this 500 or 600 year cycle, you know, reached its endpoint. You know, and people see that, they get that now, they or at least some of it. They get that, oh, these tools don't really work for the job that we thought they were intended for. So we're going to need other tools, other ways of doing business, other ways of generating capital, other ways of transacting. But they still don't look at the net as a way of enacting that. So that's why I then went back a step with this book, this program or be programmed book to tell people, look, if you approach these technologies, even if you don't know programming, if you approach them from the perspective of a programmer, you don't feel as controlled by them. You feel much more the user than the used. You make much more active and conscious choices about what technologies you're going to deploy and how you're going to deploy them. You know, and that's when you see a guy, you know, like Assange, I can't even say his name, the WikiLeaks guy, he's like, oh, I get it. I can just take Wiki and use some anonymous proxy servers and let people start sharing all that information that's out there that's, you know, otherwise locked up in very, you know, clandestine fashions. You know, these are the people that are using these technologies in ways that allow us to rebuild our society in a way that's much more consonant with what we want now. You know, so rather than subscribing to some dream, whether it's capitalism or Christianity or whatever it might be, where there's some end that's supposed to justify the current means and the current suffering, we can go, wait a minute, no, we want it right now, because now is when we're alive. You know, now is when it's actually happening. And that the people that are trying to take you away from now are not your friends. These are the people that are trying to put you off balance so that you don't see what's going on and that so you don't enact the world that you want to enact.
Well, the paradox for this, and maybe this connects some of the dots for me, is that we come out of this, you know, middle-aged thing where you're dealing with the merchant class rising up and the monarchy saying, oh, no, you won't, and creating this corporate thing. And then you have the corporations, oh, I don't know, about 120 years ago or so, figuring out that they have to be entities and be basically like people. So they have as much right to exist as we do, a corporate entity. And now you see people going around trying to brand themselves so that they can then be more like corporations, and the web, the social media, basically being almost like an interface to have people have two lives. One is local, that's disconnected and basically unabsorbed into the Borg, into this giant conversation, and the other one that propagates there and almost operates as sort of a digital shadow that, like Second Life and some of the things we discussed in the past, can actually vivify the person on the ground, almost justify that person's existence on the ground. This, the Interpol people, they can't find this guy. He's everywhere. He's all over the web. Everyone knows this. Like, there's government officials looking for this guy's head. They can't find him all over Sweden. Now he's accused of rape. Now he's, you know, it's like, so it's almost like the human part of being a corporation and the corporate part of being a human are coming into some kind of, like, kind of syzygy, kind of gelling together. And that warped little hybrid is why I feel like all these old systems are collapsing all around us, because it's like Funko Land. We can't keep that, you call it a myth, I'll call it kind of a construct. We can't keep that delivery system alive when so many people know it's Rock Ridge from Blazing Saddles. It's a fake facade, you know, that sort of insulates nobody on either side anymore. So, again, going back to the beginning, if we understand what currency is, and we understand what value is, and we understand what relationships are supposed to be about on the web and off the web, as a media, as communicating this, and I had this discussion with another friend of mine talking about independent media versus mainstream media when it comes to covering things like, in this case, New York baseball. All the people that cover, that work for a newspaper have an editor. They have a filter. And that filter has an agenda, and that agenda has corporate sponsors. It's very controlled. You go back before the Internet was around, you had an AP wire and a UPI wire. And the personalities would then embellish and give those things weight and give those things, you know, headlines and newsworthiness. Now you have, like this Assange guy, you have this bricklayer mentality where you could take a clip from here and a clip from there and a clip, and almost like a collage, a digital collage, you can be communicating a much more kind of like a poetic and much more self-sustaining message, because once you click send, it's up there forever. That has more impact than if you were doing it face-to-face. So we've bypassed 6 or 7 layers there of communication because of the fact that
those digital things are stored in a space that the culture can't contain, but the society needs now. So we've become, in a Temetic sense, you know, the teams win. The team that these machines that hold the ideas are actually more powerful than the people that are generating them. And I just feel like that undertow is ripping apart a lot of the old structures faster than we can repair them.
Right. Well, and in certain cases, the fact that the teams or that these virtual constructs are more resilient and durable than the real life ones are why, even if they, you know, catch this guy and, you know, kill him or do whatever it is they want to do to him because they want to stop him, the entity lives on. You know, WikiLeaks or its equivalent will live on. He's demonstrated how it can be done, so
right,
anybody can model it after he's gone, which is why it's pointless. So you kill him. So what? You know, so what? For him in the real life, it's an awful thing. But all that really will do is create a martyr for this moment.
Oh, it'll inspire, just like terrorists. It's like you take out one dictator, one. It's like you're pulling weeds in a digital garden. They're gonna keep growing back.
Right.
And
I love,
like,
guys. They call it terrorism. You know. It's only terrorism to the folks that are being terrorized by it. You know, it's not terrorism to me. It's terrorism to the people that are being exposed.
Oh, that, again, that's what I'm saying. The funny part is the media is now, the mainstream media, is now in a very strange position because they've become so embedded into the government, embedded into the military, almost so that they almost speak in unison, whether you're getting a red message or a blue message, you're getting a message that's coded. It's like almost like they've resigned themselves to being puppets. And even the ones that do the critical stuff that, you know, that come on like Comedy Central every night and offer the sort of sardonic view of it, they're still skewing the same basic, because they have sponsors and they have Viacom and it just seems like our culture's become, and you've talked about this before, once something goes from being countercultural or even subcultural to getting popular, it's kind of what happened with a lot of grunge music. Once they get, oh, you've got a contract, you sold out, we're done with you. So the people that are lauding this, you know, change or want to see these things uprise, the minute it gets above the threshold of being noticed, it becomes jump the shark time and you're on to the next thing. So that's why WikiLeaks has essentially served its purpose. Now something else will leapfrog it. And they don't even know what it's going to be. And that's what's so amusing about it, is that the central, controlling, you know, kind of like old way of doing things that can't squash, it's like whack-a-mole, that can't squash the creativity that bubbles up through the technology. So in a sense, going even one level below the biological level, the epigenetic level, wherever creativity finds its core on a biological scale, We're at that point now where, I mean, this is what gets me kind of excited about all this stuff, is that we can actually undo centuries of this top-down, you know, sort of, you know, whether it was a monopoly, whether it was a monarchy, or whether it was a corporate monopoly, where they don't dominate us anymore. We can, like, I always thought it was like a great thing when, like, Ma Bell busted up and Silicon Valley came out of that, and the Silicon Alley, you know, arose, and then we had the one over here in New York when all the technological stuff came along, and you were part of that in Silicon Alley down the city. All these things that came up from creativity, from people like you said, the TV generation getting a look at, hey, we can program this thing. It went two directions, and I just see everybody that's sort of in the old guard wanting to go back to it being one direction, where they can embed a message in your brain, and like the Fox News audience, nobody thinks, nobody questions, everyone just accepts it, you know, like you're just sticking, you know, mail in a slot there, that's all you get. Now, I think because there's so many tooth fairies that have been kind of like revealed as being phony, now I'm seeing a much more, I don't want to say mature populace, but a much more jaded populace that just either gets one or two flavors. They either get resigned and they disengage and they sort of just passively let it go on, or they get fed up and,
right,
and they go around
the,
it.
The interesting thing about the whole Fox News side of it is the Fox News people and the Tea Party and all that, they've really
yeah.
co-opted the very meme that we're talking about. The people who are you know, listening to those radio shows, they think that they are deconstructing the elitist system put in place by the conspiracy of the left. In other words, they think that they're doing the very thing that we're describing, where actually what they're doing is they're being tasked to smash inquiry as if inquiry and thought and consideration were the idols. You know, it's on the one hand, we have a left and a progressive thinking culture that's paralyzed by the iconoclasm of this era. You know, it took 600 years to build the idols that we've lived by, and it's going to be shocking. It's always shocking when you tear them down. You know, it took however many hundred years for the Egyptians and the Canaanites to build their idols, and then it took Abraham, when he's a kid, you know, in the Bible, it takes him 10 minutes to smash all his dad's idols. You know, you smash these things a lot faster, but you don't have the same recovery time to deal with the disillusionment. So what usually happens is, and I'm as much a victim of it as anybody, you end up, instead of going into despair or despondency, you end up going into a kind of a cynicism or a nihilism. You know, which isn't
right. Yeah, nihilism is what I'm getting from most people around.
And
here.
The other ones look at our nihilism, the nihilism of the left, of the progressive side, and you know, us saying that this isn't right and nothing really works. They look at that as the top-down message of the media elites. They think that the media is leftward biased, and that all of their activity and their hooting and hollering is a genuinely active and intelligent smashing of cultural icons, where what they're doing is actually just smashing anyone or anything that's thinking, anything that's actually forcing us to look at reality, you know, and that's a shame, because they're much more energetic about it than we are. You know, it's much...
Yeah, it's funny. You have this sort of crank mentality that the right has always been really able to tap into, whether it's militias or whether it's abortion or whatever topic they want to pick, very visceral stuff. But they sort of, they're intellectual about it. They're very much a gut sense, and this is the truth, and they wave a flag or they wave a Bible at them, and it's like the zombies come out of the forest, where the progressives want to feel nothing, want to almost do nothing. They want to intellectualize it to the point where they're just going to conceive it in their heads and sort of, this is the right way, and they have this moral high ground to them. And you have that sort of dichotomy again, just like I was saying before, between the human corporate and the corporate human, is that now, because we've divided things so successfully and you have such clear polarity, anyone that moves to the middle gets sort of deleted. Because they're not visible anymore, because there's not a home for them, either intellectually or viscerally. So we're left with this sort of weightless body that just holds a lot of mixed gray ideas that don't have a lot of charge to them. And those are the ones that balance everything. So we're sort of forced to choose between two extremes. And what I see the Tea Party people doing very kind of unwittingly, I guess, is that they're corporately sponsored and highlighted and amplified by, you know, Roger Ailes and his friends, and they're doing a disservice to their own cause, but they don't know it. It's like a dog chasing its tail. But then I see the progressives standing there with their hands on their hips, not doing a whole lot of anything, and they're not engaging because they feel like, well, why bother? Because of the nihilism. So
right.
On a digital level, when you look at the media, and we're going to get to your book here in a second about, you know, so people can start
you know, get a little stocking stuffer. We've got seven more days of Hanukkah here and get this book. Start getting to the point where they get proactive rather than reactive, and using their tools, using the things that they can communicate with, so that something moves off its dime and doesn't get pushed forward, doesn't get pushed into the next election cycle or whatever. So we're not waiting for someone else to come to us with an answer. We're providing a local answer for ourselves and our community, our circle, and it spreads out from individuals into the culture rather than from the culture to the individuals.
Right.
So
we get
bridging us from Life Inc., where we sort of impersonalized ourselves with money to get away from, you know, to basically kind of operate under that centralized government, that umbrella that was going to protect us from everything, and almost like a feudal system, to now where we want this Wild West, this digital Wild West, but we don't even know how to ride a horse. How do we, someone who's not technically, and I would look at myself as moderately technically savvy. I spend more time trying to figure out these things than I do really using them for anything productive. But you look at the Kindle, and you look at the 4G phones, and you look at the portability, all the mobile media now, where everything's, like I said, news drips now. How do we, as I would say, from the age ranges of late 20s to late 40s, where you're working and you got a family, and maybe you have a mortgage, and you have something that's riding on not just you, you have something that you're trying to work for, so to speak, in a traditional sense. How do we use the web, using the principles in your book, to kind of ride out some of these storms, especially going into December here, and so we're not programmed by the culture to do things that are against our self-interest?
Well, I mean, what I did in this book, in Programmer Be Programmed, was accepted the fact that most people are not going to learn how to program. You know, the easy thing, you know, to tell people as society, say, as we move from the oral stage to the literate stage, would be to tell them, look, if you're going to live in a literate culture, it would really serve you to know how to read and write, you know? It just would. Most people were not going to. You know, it took 1,000 years till people started to actually learn to read and write. It just looked too difficult. We didn't have schools and all that. And I understand programming now looks too difficult to people. You know, there's places they can go. You can go into MIT's website and learn how to do Scratch, a very simple kids programming language that changes the way you then look at computers. You can go to Google, to the Google App Builder, and get very simple tools for making your own apps for the Android system, for Google Android phones and the Motorola phone and all the Droid and all that. And it's very easy. You just basically drag stuff around and create just a kind of a timeline of events for how a program works. And even if you don't become a programmer as a result of that, you end up looking at the programs you're using differently. You start to look and you say, all these ways that my programs seem to be broken, all of the ways that they seem not to work or not to do what I want, is that because they're actually broken, because the people who made them didn't know how to do it? Or is it because the people who made them didn't want me to do that, because that's not what the program is really for? You know, what the book really does is help people understand that the tools they're using have purposes embedded in them, so that a kid using Facebook to find and make and keep friends can realize, oh, Facebook wasn't actually made to help me make friends. Facebook is designed to help, you know, companies monetize my relationships, to help marketers figure out who I am, to create consumer profiles. Once you understand that that's what it's for, you start to see, oh, the reason I feel uncomfortable here, or the reason why I'm being forced to do this instead of that, is because the program wasn't written for me. It was written for someone else, the person who's paying for that program. So really, the point of my book is to help people get to that place where they can start to see the logic of the stuff that they're using. And then they can much more purposefully decide, when do we use it and when do we not? You know, it's as simple as I gave a talk at a university in Tennessee, and they took me to this classroom. They were so proud of it, where they were having kids come to this classroom, they would immediately log into computers, log into Second Life, and then engage with each other in a Second Life recreation of their classroom. And I was supposed to tell them, oh, isn't this great? You're so advanced. They're putting it on the cover of their course catalog. And I told them that they were crazy. You know, here you've got these kids spending all this money to actually be live and present in the university. You get them all into a room, into a seminar room together, and then you don't let these 20 kids and a professor actually interact. Instead, you give them what you could have gotten for 25 cents in a distance learning course. You know, it's incredible. So the point of this book is to help people look at each of the biases of digital media to say, okay, digital media is good for long distance. It's good for asynchronous things, things that are not happening in real time. You know, so you don't want to take your iPhone and plug it into your brain and have it vibrate you every time someone wants to ping you with a message. The beauty of email was that you got to it in your own time. So all those kinds of sensibilities, once people become aware of them, then they can go and they say, oh, I don't want to put my business online because that's just going to undercut my bottom line. Or I don't want to spend my time doing this. I want to spend my time and money doing that. And once people can make decisions consciously rather than just employing technologies because that's what's done, they end up being really what I'm calling the programmers. They're then the masters of their existence rather than the used of technology.
Well, we're moving, I guess, into an age where you must be much more able to emphasize the intellectual part of property in order to use the web, because if you just put it out instinctively, like what's gone on with with Twitter and Facebook and something, where we just instinctively, like a hive, we just all run to the hive. And you've seen how many people have been, TMZ to death because of, just recently, the guy with the Eva Longoria there, Parker, down there in San Antonio, he gets basically divorced because of texts that he had from a year ago with his phone. I mean, it's like, didn't you learn from Tiger Woods that you erase the texts? It's almost as if that ignorance, and maybe to some degree arrogance, of the digital, you almost feel like, and it happened a lot more, back in the, when you were more anonymous, like on MySpace, but less than on Facebook, where you can have an alternate identity. You could be somebody else. You can have Second Life. You can have all these alternate universes out there. And now they're all colliding, and they're all personalizing, so they're all folding back on us again. And I just feel like we have to go back to a different consciousness about what identity is, so that we know what we are, because who we are is a story we make up, and people sell it and buy it and back and forth. And because, like, I always go back to that thing. I think you did it in, it's got to be the late 90s. It was in that Edge thing, the name of the guy. And
John,
there was an article
Stockton
that you posted called,
The Thing Called Doug.
Yeah, right. And maybe go back to that. Talk about that for a minute, because that article was so, it just hit me right between the eyes. If that's what I'm talking about when I got into the somatic world, and talking about the extended self and talking about an open identity versus a closed identity. And the thing called Doug is not you. And maybe you could kind of like expound on that for a minute so people understand that, because that's such a core thing about understanding how technology can work with you or against you.
Well, it's funny. It's definitely technology makes it apply to everybody, but it's the kind of thing that applied to people in my field really forever. This was a conversation I was having with John Brockman, who's an intellectual and he's very knowledgeable about science and technology and all, but he's also a literary agent, and he's become actually my agent. And he thinks of things largely in terms of business as well as ideas. He markets ideas, in the form of books. So he was talking to me about kind of Doug Rushkoff, the writer, and what is this thing that's out there, and my public image and creating a public image on the net and the way that public image then interacts with other people and what it says. And I wanted to make a distinction for him between that public image, between the author, Douglas Rushkoff, that's out there online and that people have various opinions about, and the guy that was sitting in front of him, namely me, you know, that there's still me and that I can try to make that thing that's out there really consonant with what I am and what I believe, but that thing that's out there is an avatar. You know, it really is. It's something I'm controlling, and that, yeah, when people attack it, I feel pain because I believe in the things that guy is saying. You know, I believe in, I have a stake, a financial and a personal and a spiritual stake in that representation, but I'm aware that it's a representation, that it's this thing that's out there. You know, it's why a lot of artists over time have used pseudonyms. You know, they'll put out this thing and they'll use a pseudonym, and then they'll even kill one off and then create another one. You know, and it's not necessarily an unhealthy thing to do. My avatar, my Douglas Rushkoff, the author, online personality, speaker, you know, has the same name that I do, because I've seen it kind of as my project to integrate those two things, to have them be, if not one and the same, to have them congruent, you know, so that, you know, I don't buy the idea that I can be, you know, a bastard in business and then nice to my daughter at home and have that make sense on some level. It doesn't make sense for me. It would eat me up. So, you
know,
it's
a classic bromide, though, in the culture, right? Because people say, oh, it's just business. That means, that gives you an excuse to be the most impersonal, self-centered, you know, sort of just interested in exploiting the weaknesses of others, and then you go back and you're like this great person in the neighborhood. I don't know how they reconcile that, but that's part of the personal branding thing.
It is.
The brand
did
it, not me.
Right, and you know, in Jewish mythology, in theory, the first question that they ask about you after you die, when they're deciding what to do with you, is, you know, how was he in business? You know, that's how you know who he really was.
That's
you know,
the first question they ask you after you die?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because that's where the stuff hits the fan. That's where
all the moral dilemmas are, sure.
Right. That's where, you know, that's why half the Talmud is about, you know, your business dealings, the big things. I mean, it really does change how you feel about things. So, you know, one of the laws in Talmud is supposed to be, if someone does something for you, if you hire somebody, you're supposed to pay them before nightfall. You know, so it's so funny because a contractor will come in and, you know, fix something in my basement, and they'll be, I'll send you a bill, whatever. I go, no, let me pay you now. You know, it's always so refreshing to them, but it feels really good. You're just done with it. They did the thing. They created value, and you paid them right away. You know, there's just not, you know, as someone who chases down invoices for months after I do talks or write a magazine piece or something, I mean, I know what it feels like to be on the other side of that, but the immediacy, the nowness, you know, of exchanging value right away is it's refreshing. It's real. You know, it's not dirty. You know, we've got this idea that, you know, that money is somehow dirty. You know, I remember when we were supposed to buy you know, gifts or tips or Christmas things, whatever it is, for the nursery school teachers where my daughter was going to school. And so they took a collection of like $10 from each parent or $20 a parent, and then they went to the supermarket and they bought American Express gift cards for these people, which end up costing like 10-15% more. Like, you buy a $100 gift card, it costs like $120. And I'm like,
yeah.
So this is $20 we could have spent. We could have taken the $20 off each gift card and then and given money to the janitor or to the guard, or given them more money, you know, but No, we can't do that. You can't just put cash in an envelope. It's like, oh, no, so I'll put in this little piece of plastic with a Christmas sticker on it, you know, which is basically cash in an envelope, pretending not to be.
Yeah, and again, what you're talking about there is actually the opposite of the debt culture, and it sort of smacks of, God, my memory just went back to, like, high school, Death of a Mockingbird, where that woman says, I'll never owe anybody before I die, you know? And it's like, it's that mentality of having a like you said the word before, a congruent relationship with people you do business with leaves no residue. When you have incongruence on either side, it leaves a lot of residue, which leads to more people trying to basically exploit each other because they feel they've been slighted. So you sort of leave people, you know, feeling like I just got taken or I got rooked or I got someone basically bamboozled me. And I'm gonna show them. I'm gonna bamboozle somebody else. And that mentality has now basically taken over the entire global economy. Everybody feels like they're getting a raw deal and nobody's honest.
Right. And then, I mean, that notion of residue is really significant. I mean, think of the way, I mean, and listeners should too, think of the way you relate to the inbox in your you know, email program. It's like, if can you go to sleep knowing that there's messages in there that you haven't looked at? You know, well, you damn well should be able to. You know, it's like there's two approaches. The one approach that most people use is, okay, I'm going to check my email again at, you know, 11 o'clock at night right before I go to bed just to make sure there's nothing in there and to get that thing empty or to get it dealt with, and then I can feel clean and go to sleep. Well, the fact is you're never going to feel clean. There's always going to be something there. You can't. The one of the main artifacts of the digital age is that you will always have these loose ends. There's always going to be more pings to address. You're going to be pinged all the time. So you've got to be able to step above that and go, no, they are not pinging me. They are pinging my email. They are pinging my computer. They are pinging a server somewhere in Google land and putting their text into my inbox. Someone else is putting text into your inbox. That doesn't mean that you've got to get that text out of your inbox in order for you to rest. It's their problem, not yours.
And unfortunately, there's a whole generation that's grown up with a phone in their hand texting, that they fall asleep with that phone, you know, texting, and they wake up texting. So they're never disengaged. There's actually less space because email is more discontinuous than texting. And they just feel like they're constantly, like one of the principles in your book is to not be online all the time.
Right.
That might take a generational cycle.
Exactly. Even the Maytag repairman guy took the beeper off when he went to sleep. You know, the idea that people think it's empowered to have that device pinging at you all the time, it's not. That's being enslaved by the device. The person who's empowered by the device is the person who knows they can put it down. You know, the worker puts his shovel down at the end of the day and gets in his shack and has sex with his wife and eats a mango and goes back to work the next day and picks up the shovel. You know, the first world iPhone owners owe themselves the same luxury to not be working all the time.
Yeah, like hopefully with the holiday season just starting, then we'll get that message because you know and I know that the message from the corporate octopus is going to be connect more, connect to the point where you can't disconnect, and then, as they say, they got you. So,
The holiday season is the funny thing about it is, you know, people look forward to the holiday season as this break, you know, for like 2 or 3 months until they get to the second day of the holiday season when they realize, oh, right, this is what the holiday season is. It's more work and more anxiety and driving around and buying things, and I can't wait till this is over and I can just get back to the calmness of regular work.
It's an incredible transition when you go through where you are, say, December 10th to where we are, say, January 10th, in terms of your social density of your life. You go from having a 6.5-day week where there's absolutely hardly any break. You get your hands on your knees on Sunday night. You go right back in the pool and parties and this and that. And then you get there, you're scraping the ice off your windshield around January 10th, and there's nobody around. And it's like it's back to this. And to me, that's when the holidays kick in for me, because you can kind of like catch your breath a little, because the winter is supposed to be a very reflective and internal and sort of sacred time to renew yourself. It's the death cycle, really, in terms of seasonal stuff. And what we do is we go tom-tomming around almost to the point where we compromise ourselves, because our cultural conditioning is so 180 degrees from the biological imperative that it why do people get suicidal, depressed? It's all part of the fact that we're not really kind of oriented toward the way nature's rhythms are guiding us. But
that's another story, and that's my somatic curse. but back to the thing we were originally talking about, I mean, the problem for so many people is when they have that realization, when they see it clearly, they experience so much disillusion and heartache that it doesn't liberate them from it. You know, if people instead said, oh, right, this is more of the rat race, this is that, you can just step off the treadmill. You don't have to then smash the treadmill. You don't have to then post blog posts about, oh my God, the treadmill is so awful, we've got to unite and organize a national campaign against the treadmill of Christmas. Because no. Then you're not getting the prize. You're not getting the benefit of what you've just realized. Instead, you're moving into anger and cynicism and despair and all that. No, the beauty of seeing it as the ridiculous treadmill cycle crap that it is that then it frees you to go, oh my gosh, nothing's actually required of me. I can just be. I can just be. And that's such a relief. That's all. That's the only get there and then stop. You know, you don't have
well,
to go
I mean,
the
silent
step
level,
step
I mean, boy, we're really getting into general semantics now, but the, you know, one of the best kind of, I guess, kind of paraphrasing here, I think it was Churchill, said that silence is the most underused, the most powerful form of communication we have, and we've abandoned it. So, you know, they say silence is golden. A lot of times, just quiet is all you need to start getting to the point where you can get rest and you can recover. But most people don't. They will go till they're exhausted. There'll be somebody trampled at some Walmart somewhere in the next 3 weeks for no reason at all. And I think, like you said, I think the program or reprogram principle applies. And a lot of people are just willing to be programmed, and there's a lot of people willing to program them. So hopefully they'll pick up your book, and there'll be more curly blocks out there in the new year. And I wish your family happy Hanukkah and all that. And I will see you at Summer's Space instead of Summertime next week. And thanks for joining us tonight. Again, Rushkoff.com. He's got all his books up there. You could just spend all kinds of good money. Because he's not only got good information for you, but he actually takes a good chunk of what he makes on these books and tries to make us more literate, both to the digital media and to the literate media itself. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and explaining all this to people, because I think the panic button has almost been pushed to the point where it's going to fall off the board, so to speak. And hopefully the world will keep turning, and we'll be able to chat again soon in the new year.
I think it will. All right. Thanks a lot.
Much coherence. Be well. Travel light. Okay. All right. There goes the Rushkoff. And we are at the bottom of the hour, so we will then extend our little wishes here for a happy Hanukkah to everybody out there as we begin the formal part of December. Little Adam Sandler to play us out.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Dray Bell.
And you guys join us next week. Big final celebration as we get back here on the last night of Hanukkah, actually. Next Wednesday night. I don't know if we'll do this again. But everybody out there who's partaking, enjoy it. Celebrate the season as best you can. Get that holiday spirit going, because when hope is lost, there's nothing else left but the hopeless. And I'm a Mets fan telling you this. So I wish you the travel light through the darkness. Thank you very much for joining us in this time and your space. Be yourself and be well. See you here next week, 9 o'clock, you podcasting fools. And keep your eye on the sparrow.
You will feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree. I guess my first two songs can do it for you. So here comes number three. Austin, Phoebe from France, say the Hanukkah blessing. So does Lenny, Pop, Squiggy, and Will and Grayson, Deborah Messing. Melinda, Gilbert, and Michael, and it never mixed with Gary. Maybe they should have called that show Little Kosher House on the Prairie. We got Jerry Lewis.
disastrous, but a full-time Oscar winner. Jennifer Connelly's half-human too, and I'd like to put some more in her.